Cypress County during the 1920s than it was now. The Depression had taken a bite out of its membership. But Jumbo Pritchard still led the robed and hooded group when it marched in the Confederate Day parade. He would make things tough for a colored man seen talking to a white woman. In fact, any encounters outside of the everyday working relationship could prove to be a problem for Freeman, and Lizzie didn't want to cause him any trouble. "Does your brother still live in Maysville?" Lizzie asked. "Maybe I could go to his house or talk to him on the phone." She might have suggested that he come over and mow her lawn or paint her front porch swing, but she didn't want to put him in that position. It was dishonest and demeaning. Freeman had been a proud boy. She hoped the man hadn't changed.
"He do. But his wife won't appreciate you coming to their house," Sally Lou said firmly. "And his neighbors might see you and be wondering what a white lady be doing what she's doing. Plus, he don't have no telephone."
Lizzie felt embarrassed. Of course Freeman didn't have a phone. Most folks in Maysville didn't. Sally Lou was silent for a moment. Finally, she said,
"I reckon I could ask him if he'd come over to your house with me after supper tonight, later after it's dark. I could sit on the back porch while using him talk."
"Oh, would you?" Lizzie asked in a grateful rush. "Thank you very much."
"Can't promise," Sally Lou said, "but I can try."
She hesitated.
"Not sure I should tell him why, though. You reckon?"
"I agree." Lizzie hated to do it that way, but she was afraid he might not come if he knew why he was being asked, especially if he had seen...
Seen what?
She couldn't know the answer to that, though, until she had talked to Freeman.
"I won't, then," Sally Lou chuckled wryly. "That boy will probably say more if he took by surprise and don't got the time to plan it out ahead."
Lizzie agreed with that, too, but she didn't like to say so. "What time do you want to come?"
"Let's say 7:30. You at Mr. Mosley's office today?"
"Yes, I'll be here until 5.
"I'll phone Freeman over at the Standard and see what he says. If and you don't hear from me, let's count on 7:30. We'll come to the back door."
"Thank you," Lizzie said again. "I really appreciate this, Sally Lou."
"Don't thank me yet," Sally Lou warned, and hung up.
Lizzie sat back in her chair, thinking. She was caught up on her work for Mr. Mosley, and she had gone just about as far as she could, for the moment, with the Whitworth affair. Freeman might be able to add something tonight, or he might not, in which case the whole thing would simply have to wait until Mr. Whitworth turned up. In the meantime, she could work on The Garden Gate, the weekly column she wrote for the Dispatch. She had already started it, so she reached into the drawer, took out the pages she had done, and set to work. Chapter 12. The Garden Gate by Elizabeth Lacey. Looking for luck? Find it in your garden. At a recent meeting of the Darling Dahlia's Garden Club, Miss Rogers, Darling's librarian and noted plant historian, gave a talk on plants that can bring their owners good fortune. She was speaking in honor of Darling's own lucky four clovers, our town's hands-down favorite to win the Dixie Regional Barbershop Quartet competition. She has given me permission to use her notes for this column. Thank you, Miss Rogers, and good luck, you lucky four clovers. Your hometown friends are rooting for you. The four-leaf clover, Trifolium repens. Miss Rogers reported that she found one of these lucky clovers recently growing beside the path to the library. Following the advice of an old saying, she picked the clover and put it in her shoe, so she could have good luck until the next new moon. Another legend has it that when you find a four-leaf clover, you'll see a fairy. Unfortunately, that hasn't worked out so well for Miss Rogers, maybe because Darling's fairies have moved somewhere else. In Ireland, a four-leaf clover can protect you from evil spirits. In ancient Rome, it could protect you from poisonous snakes. On the Ivory Coast of Africa, a four-leaf clover is a symbol of power. Find one, and you can be chief of the tribe. The four-leaf clover seems to be a universal symbol of good fortune, perhaps because it is rare everywhere, but occurs just often enough to keep us looking. People who count such things tell us that one out of every 10,000 clovers has four leaves. The Latin name of this plant, Trifolium repens, describes its usual three leaves and its habit of creeping across the ground. Miss Rogers suggests that if you find a four-leaf clover, you might call it Quadrifolium repens. She even proposed that the lucky four clovers consider changing the name of their quartet to Quadrifolium repens, but this suggestion was met with great disapproval. Jade plant, Crassula ovata. This lucky plant's common names tell us why people treasure it. Money tree, money plant, lucky plant, dollar plant, and prosperity plant. Usually grown as a house plant, the glossy round leaves of the jade plant resemble valuable jade coins. In Asia, where it is especially prized, jade plant is often given as a gift to a new business, to a new bride and groom, or to an infant. It is also given as a New Year's gift to bring wealth and good fortune throughout the year. Carry several of the shiny green coins in your pocket and see if they bring you some silver. Lucky bamboo, Dracaena cinerariana, looks like bamboo with its woody, segmented stalk and bright green leaves, but it's not invasive. A houseplant often grown in water, its genus name, Dracaena, comes from a Greek word that means female dragon, so called because of its paradoxical association with independent strength and compliance. The flexible stems of lucky bamboo are often bent into intricate shapes. In China, this plant goes by the name Fu Gui, Fu for luck and fortune, Gui for power and honor. The number of stalks of Fu Gui suggest different kinds of luck, 3 for happiness and long life, 5 for wealth, 7 for good health. Groups of stems, 3 times 3 stems, 3 times 5, 3 times 7, are thought to bring happiness, wealth, and health several times over. Another lucky thing about this plant, it requires almost no care at all. If you're growing it in water, though, be sure to replace the water every few days to reduce algae growth. Morning glories, Ipomoea, in your garden are said to bring you peace and happiness, and guaranteed to bring a smile when you see them. If you put morning glory seeds under your pillow, your sleep will be restful and free of bad dreams. The Aztecs believed that the plant was a way of connecting with the sun god. Carrying the seeds would bring great good fortune. In voodoo tradition, the root of one plant in this genus, Jalap, Ipomoea jalapa, is reputed to bring good luck in anything relating to money, but especially in gambling and flirting. Carry the woody tuber in your pocket, or attach it to a chain or ribbon, and wear it as an amulet. Buckeye, Aesculus glabra, nuts, dried, oiled, polished, are also carried in the pocket or worn as an amulet. The buckeye tree is a relative of the chestnut, and the nut is the same rich, mellow brown, but don't try to eat it. It will make you sick. Like the jalap root, the buckeye was thought to attract good fortune in the form of money and the ladies. Miss Rogers said that she wouldn't go into that part of it in her talk, but if you're interested, drop in at the library and she can show you where to look that up. Sunflower, Helianthus annuus. If you have planted sunflowers around your house or in your backyard, you are doubly lucky. Those large, sunny yellow flowers are guaranteed to brighten your day and bring you good fortune. At the same time, the tall, sturdy plants will serve as a shield to protect your home from bad luck. Other traditions. Pick a sunflower at sunset, wear it in your buttonhole the next day, and you'll have good luck all day long. Sleep with a sunflower under your pillow. Before sunset the next day, you will learn a truth you are seeking. Persimmons, peaches, oranges, and pomegranates. Sometimes called the four fruits of good fortune, each of these symbolizes a different aspect of good luck. Persimmons represent friendship, happiness, and a smooth path through life. In Korea, a persimmon can also scare away a tiger, although Miss Rogers does not recommend that you try this. The peach symbolizes contentment in marriage and longevity. The orange stands for prosperity and financial success. The pomegranate, which has a great many seeds, represents good fortune through many children. Keep a bowl of these four fruits in your home and eat one every day, and you will certainly have good fortune. Miss Rogers ended her talk by saying that it is all well and good to trust in luck, and it certainly won't hurt to have a four-leaf clover in your shoe, a sunflower in your buttonhole, morning glories on your fence, and a persimmon, a peach, an orange, and a pomegranate in a bowl on your table. But she has more confidence in the words of Thomas Jefferson, who said, "I'm a great believer in luck, and I find the harder I work, the more I have of it." The Dahlias thanked Miss Rogers for another informative talk and then adjourned for cookies and punch provided by refreshment committee members Ophelia Snow and Erlyn Biddle. Erlyn says that several people asked her for her persimmon cookie recipe. If you're one of them, here it is. Erlyn Biddle's Persimmon Cookies. 1 cup persimmon pulp, about 2 to 3 ripe persimmons. 1 teaspoon baking soda. 1 cup sugar. 1/2 cup butter at room temperature. 1 egg beaten. 2 cups flour. 1 teaspoon cinnamon. 1/2 teaspoon ground cloves, 1/2 teaspoon ground nutmeg, 1/2 teaspoon powdered ginger, 1/2 teaspoon salt. 1 cup chopped pecans, walnuts, or what have you. 1 cup raisins. Preheat the oven to 375 degrees Fahrenheit. In a large mixing bowl, beat the persimmon pulp, soda, sugar, and butter until creamy. Gently stir the beaten egg into the persimmon mixture along with flour, spices, salt, nuts, and raisins. Using a teaspoon, drop dough on a greased baking sheet and bake for 12 to 15 minutes. Makes about 3 dozen. Erlyn says persimmons are very sharp tasting unless they are dead ripe and soft. But please don't leave them on the ground to get that way, or the raccoons and possums will have a feast and you'll come up empty-handed. Bring the persimmons in, wash them, and let them ripen in a paper bag, not in your icebox, until they're squishy. Peel them, take out the seeds, and chop. Then put them in a big bowl and whack them with your potato masher. After that, you can put them through a potato ricer or a food mill, and you'll end up with perfect persimmon pulp. Or, if you've got a mesh laundry bag, Erlyn got hers from the Sears and Roebuck catalog, put your peeled, seeded persimmons in the bag and squeeze. However you do it, clean up afterward. Persimmon pulp dries sticky. Erlyn says it is the very worst glue you've seen in all your life. Chapter 13. Bessie Goes to the Five and Dime. About the time that Liz began working on her garden column, Bessie Bloodworth, freshly shampooed, cut, curled, and combed out, had just left the beauty bower and was on her way to do some shopping. The previous year, Bessie had served on the Bridge Club's calendar committee with Mrs. Whitworth, and she was tempted to make a quick detour over to Peachtree Street and tell that poor woman how distressed she had been to learn that her husband had been kidnapped. It would certainly be the courteous thing to do, but Bessie reluctantly decided against it. Mrs. Whitworth was probably pacing the floor and biting her fingernails, waiting for the kidnappers to call about the ransom. Bessie certainly hoped that her telephone was working. Anyway, the courthouse clock said it was after 11. The residence at the manor, the Magnolia Manor, the genteel boarding house for elderly ladies that Bessie owned and managed, had given her their Monday list of things to pick up. She had better get started, or she wouldn't get home in time for lunch. Bessie was headed for the Five and Dime on the south side of the courthouse square. On her list, 3 yards of narrow cream-colored lace to trim the pink cotton nightie Letitia Wiggins was making, a card of small brass safety pins for Miss Rogers, a charm curl permanent wave kit for Maxine Bechtel, and a bar of Lifebuoy soap for Mrs. Sedalius, who had shown Bessie a magazine ad so she would be sure to get the right brand. I value my daintiness too much to ever take a chance with B.O., so naturally I use Lifebuoy. None of Bessie's ladies were what you might call well-off. In fact, Maxine was 2 months behind on her board bill, and they all cut corners where they could. Most folks had to do that these days, especially older ladies who had no children to take care of them. Everybody at the manor was on pins and needles to see what President Roosevelt was going to do about getting them an old age pension. Letitia even went so far as to declare that if FDR was on the ballot in 1936, she wouldn't vote for him unless he got a pension bill through Congress. Most agreed that aid for the elderly was sorely needed, but some accused Mr. Roosevelt of getting his idea, Social Security it was called, from Francis Perkins, his Secretary of Labor, and said that it was one of the soft-headed notions you got when you made the mistake of installing a woman on the president's cabinet. Bessie herself was a staunch supporter of Louisiana Senator Huey Long, who understood what folks needed and promised to get it for them. In the meantime, the residents at the manor had to watch every penny they spent. Darling was too small and out of the way for a Woolworth's. The nearest was down in Mobile. But Darling folk were just as happy with their five and dime, which was owned by Reginald Dunlap. Dunlap sold just about anything under the sun as long as it had a 5 or 10 cent price tag. The rock-bottom prices were designed to make shoppers feel rich, because they could buy lots of different things, even if they didn't always need them. What's more, everything was on the counter with an easy reach, instead of being on shelves behind the counter, the way it was at Mann's Mercantile. At Dunlap's, you could pick something up and finger it and sniff it while you decided whether or not you could get along without it. If you didn't, there wasn't any clerk to frown and make you feel guilty for giving him the trouble of putting it back on the shelf. Five and Dimes had gotten off to a rocky start. Frank Woolworth's first store, in Utica, New York, back in 1878, was a failure. Nothing daunted, he put up the same red and gold sign, Woolworth's Great 5 Cent Store, at another location. Another failure. Landlord problems closed the third store, and the fourth, in York, Pennsylvania, went broke in 3 months. But shoppers flocked to the fifth store in Scranton, which boasted mahogany counters with glass dividers and glass-fronted showcases, bright lighting, and polished wooden floors. By 1912, when the company went public, there were 596 stores, and the sale of stock brought over $30 million. In the threadbare 30s, department stores everywhere went out of business, but not the dime store. It was designed to weather tough times. Darling's Five and Dime was one of a handful of stores conveniently located on the Courthouse Square, the hub of the little town. On the east side of the square was Mann's Mercantile, which carried clothing and boots and tools and bolts of yard goods and kitchenware. And even in the back room, on a secret shelf behind the horse harness and saddles, bottles of corn whiskey. Bessie wasn't in the market for moonshine, but everybody in town knew where to get it when they wanted it. On the north side was Musgrove's Hardware, which had everything you needed if you were building something or fixing something up. Plumbing, roofing, lumber, stacked out back, and fence wire. Baby chicks and ducklings and turkey poults in the spring, trucked in from the hatchery over at Monroeville, and seed potatoes and green onion sets for gardeners. Next to Musgrove's was the Diner and the Exchange, owned by Myra May and Violet, which was the unfortunate focus of Darling's discontent these days. Next door to the Diner was the Darling Dispatch, where Ophelia Snow was a reporter and sold advertising. And upstairs, over the Dispatch, was Mr. Mosley's law office, where Liz Lacey worked. Bessie always smiled when she thought that on the north side of the square, five dahlias were blooming in a row. Myra May, Violet, and Raylene at the Diner, Ophelia at the Dispatch, and Liz at the law office upstairs. Next door to the Dispatch was Hancock's Grocery, Darling's only grocery store. Mrs. Hancock was sometimes rude and short-tempered,
and she liked to give you her temperance lecture while she was getting your order together and figuring up how much she was owed. But she would also give you credit if you asked for it, or trade a dozen fresh eggs from your backyard chickens for 2 pounds of flour, or a pound of your fresh-churned butter for a half pound of Hill's Brothers ground coffee. And if your grocery bags were heavy, Mrs. Hancock would ask old Zeke to load them in his red wagon and deliver them to your kitchen door. Before the crash, Bessie had heard talk about the possibility of the AMP putting one of those newfangled self-service grocery stores, a supermarket, it was called, on the vacant lot on the south side of the square, where Sevier's stationery had burned down back in the summer of 1927. People said it would be the kind of store where you carried a metal shopping basket over your arm and collected what you wanted rather than waiting while Mrs. Hancock did it for you. Then you took your basket to a girl who sat behind a cash register at the front of the store, where you paid for everything and then carried it home yourself. But Bessie thought this was just talk, with the economy so shaky. At least, she hoped so. If the AMP came to Darling, that would likely mean the end of Hancock's. But while self-service might be convenient, the AMP wouldn't give you credit. You'd have to pay every time you needed groceries, which might mean going without sugar or tea or coffee until Friday rolled around and you got your paycheck. The AMP wouldn't take your eggs and butter either. They had plenty of their own. And no delivery. Old Zeke would be out of a job and you'd be toting your own shopping bags. When Bessie got to Dunlap's, she saw that something new had been added. Up to now, the front window had been a hodgepodge of whatever items had come in recently, displayed without any attention to making it pretty. Now the window itself was sparkling, and the display, an attractive arrangement of Halloween witch masks and pirate masks, and even a skeleton costume for little kids to wear when they went door-to-door for candy, was eye-catching. There were also a couple of carved jack-o'-lantern pumpkins and twisted streamers of orange and brown crepe paper with toy brown mice and a stuffed squirrel peeking out of drifts of colorful maple and sweet gum leaves. Bessie paused to admire the display, thinking that the store's appearance had definitely perked up since Mr. Dunlap, a widower with two grown-up girls, had married Audrey Lacey. The wedding had come as a big surprise to everyone in Darling, but especially to Liz, Audrey's daughter, and to Bessie, who had known her since Mrs. Dribble's elementary class in the old two-room schoolhouse on Chestnut Street. In fact, Bessie could not for the life of her understand how mild-mannered Mr. Dunlap, a small, timid man, thin-shouldered, gray-haired, with thick, round spectacles, could have summoned the courage to propose to the redoubtable widow Lacey. But there must be more to the man than met the eye, Bessie decided, for he had proposed and been accepted. After the wedding, the newlyweds had driven down to Mobile for a week at the Wild Beach Motor Inn, right on the beautiful Blue Gulf. Bessie had even gotten a postcard from the bride, with a heart drawn around the picture of the honeymoon cottage and a row of little hearts across the bottom to indicate that she was having a romantic time. When they returned from their honeymoon, Audrey had confided to Bessie that her new husband was a tiger. But the refurbished display window was just the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. Inside the store, the new Mrs. Dunlap had worked other miracles, scrubbing and waxing the wooden floors, reorganizing the messy countertops, and building attractive displays that showed off the merchandise. There were racks of men's neckties and leather belts and bins of socks and underwear and handkerchiefs. There were displays of women's rayon and cotton hosiery, and silk scarves and costume jewelry and sparkling tiered glass shelves of Cutex and Revlon nail polish in the latest match-your-dress colors of emerald green, mulberry, and cornflower blue, with a poster that showed you how to paint your nails in the popular new style. Half moons and tips left bare, with only the center of the nail polished. There was Maybelline makeup, too. Mascara in tiny red boxes with little brushes, eyeshadow in brown and black, and even, gasp, green. There was Tangy lipstick, which was advertised to change color depending on your skin tone.
Oh, and those precious little heart-shaped bottles of Blue Waltz perfume.
For boys, there were kites, of course, plus the new green and red Duncan yo-yos, an orange-painted Amos and Andy Fresh Air taxi with Amos and Andy riding in it right out of the radio show, and Mark's balsa wood airplanes with rubber band wind-up propellers. Girls could cuddle the latest Flossie Flirt doll with real shoes and a blue ribbon in her shiny brown hair, and the new bottle-tot baby doll that drank out of her bottle, wet her diaper, and closed her eyes when she was put down. There were rolls of brightly colored hair ribbons for a nickel a yard, and plastic barrettes and jacks and jumping ropes, and for girls and boys, games of authors and Old Maid and Dr. Quack, and books in the Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys series, all neatly arranged on a shelf where the kiddos could reach them. In fact, the whole store looked especially nice, Bessie thought, and Audrey Dunlap got all the credit. Mr. Dunlap ought to be very grateful, although she had to wonder whether he might repent of his bargain when Audrey got tired of managing the store and began managing him. This morning, though, Mr. Dunlap was nowhere to be seen, and Audrey herself, a large, heavy-bosomed woman with a penetrating voice, was waiting on a customer in housewares. Specifically, Bessie saw, she was urging Leona Ruth Adcock to spend 60 cents for a new skillet instead of putting a new wooden handle on her old one. Bessie had to smile. Leona Ruth, who was wearing a purple dress with purple gloves and a purple hat with shimmering cockade of peacock feathers, perched on her tight gray curls, hated to be urged to do anything. She was more than a match for Audrey and was putting up quite a fight. By the time Bessie found the lace Letitia Wiggins wanted, écru, scalloped, 7/8 of an inch wide, 7 cents a yard, Audrey had given up battling with Leona Ruth. She hurried over to dry goods to measure out Bessie's 3 yards against the wooden yardstick that was nailed to the counter. Dry goods was not self-help, since customers might yield to temptation and help themselves to an extra half yard or so. She rolled up the lace neatly and fastened it with a pin.
"Here you are, Bessie," she said. "That will be 21 cents. "I have a few other things to look for," Bessie said and offered a compliment. "That front display window looks right pretty with that crepe paper and leaves and those cute little mice. You did it all yourself, Audrey?"
Audrey pressed her lips together.
"If I'd had any idea I'd be doing store windows when I agreed to marry Mr. Dunlap, I might have told him no."
She gave an ironic little chuckle to show that she was joking, then glanced over her shoulder to see whether Leona Ruth, Darling's most notorious gossip, was loitering nearby. Leona Ruth had wandered from housewares to brooms and mops, but Audrey leaned closer and lowered her voice anyway.
"I have something to tell you."
Her voice was apprehensive, and her round face was flushed and worried.
"Something serious, I mean."
"Really? What sort of something?"
Bessie was surprised at the anxiety she heard, for in her experience, Audrey usually preferred to put on a show of being firmly in control. Apprehensive was not a word you would naturally think of when you thought about the large and domineering Audrey. Bessie suspected that something serious really was going on.
"You know Mr. Whitworth, I'm sure."
Without waiting for Bessie's answer, Audrey went on almost breathlessly.
"Well, he came over to our house yesterday evening late to talk to Mr. Dunlap about the Clovers," he said. "Mr. Whitworth sings bass, you know, and Mr. Dunlap sings tenor, and the two of them are on the arrangements committee for the Dixie Regional Competition next week." She took a breath. "But that wasn't what they talked about."
"It wasn't?"
Bessie asked. Now that she understood that this was about Mr. Whitworth, she was deeply curious. It sounded as if Audrey wasn't aware that Mr. Whitworth hadn't made it home last night, that he had been kidnapped.
"No," Audrey said in a wavering tone. "It was about their partnership."
Her voice rose and her lips trembled.
"They were downstairs in the parlor and I was in the bedroom upstairs. The hot air register in the bedroom floor is as good as an open window, you know, and I couldn't help hearing everything they said.
Privately, Bessie suspected that Audrey probably went upstairs on purpose so she could listen to what the men were saying. Audrey always liked to be fully informed. But she only said,
"It's too bad that they upset you."
Impulsively, she added, "I didn't know they were partners." It was true. As Darling's unofficial town historian, Bessie had written an article for the Dispatch a few years back on the history of the businesses around the courthouse square. As she remembered it, Mr. Dunlap had opened the Five and Dime in 1912, the same year that Woodrow Wilson beat President Taft and Teddy Roosevelt for president. And as far as she knew, Mr. Dunlap had been the store's only owner ever since.
"I didn't know it either, Bessie,"
Audrey said. Her eyes widened and her heavy jowls quivered.
"That's what's so alarming about all this. I thought Mr. Dunlap owned this store free and clear. In fact, I asked him point blank before we got married."
Defensively, she added,
"I mean, it's something a wife should know, isn't it? Of course, I asked him what kind of business obligations he had. You wouldn't expect me to jump into marriage blind, would you, at my age?"
"No," Bessie replied slowly. She had never been married, but she could see the wisdom in that. "On the other hand..."
"But there's more, Bessie," Audrey went on. "Mr. Whitworth said that Mr. Dunlap signed a paper saying that he got $1,000 from Mr. Whitworth, something called a limited partnership. And for that paltry amount, Mr. Whitworth gets half the profits forever."
"I'm afraid I don't understand," Bessie frowned. "Isn't that a rather unusual..."
"Of course it's unusual," Audrey said with an impatient wave of her hand. "The problem is that Mr. Dunlap has to buy a new oil heater before winter sets in because the old one has completely quit. And it's not just the heater, but the heat pipes, too. They have to be replaced."
She gestured toward the ceiling, where an overhead duct ran the length of the store.
"The whole thing is going to cost over $1,500. Mr. Dunlap was asking Mr. Whitworth to split the cost with him."
"That sounds reasonable," Bessie said. "Shoppers expect..."
"They expect to shop in comfort," Audrey snapped. "But Mr. Whitworth said he wasn't going to give Mr. Dunlap any money, and there was this huge argument."
She shook her head.
"A fight, actually."
"A fight?" Bessie was shocked. "You don't mean it, Audrey."
Mr. Dunlap might be a tiger in certain circumstances, but he was not a large man, not nearly as large as his wife, and he didn't look very strong. Bessie could not imagine him trading blows with Mr. Whitworth, who outweighed him by 40 or 50 pounds.
"Well, pushing and shoving anyway," Audrey said,
"and lots of shouting. Mr. Dunlap got mad, really mad, I mean, and told Mr. Whitworth to get out.
When Mr. Whitworth left, he banged the front door so hard that he broke the glass. And my poor husband..."
Her chin quivered.
"Mr. Dunlap was so upset that he had to go for a long drive just to calm himself. He wouldn't let me go with him either. He didn't come home until nearly midnight, and when he did, he was still terribly upset. He paced around the house for half the night, and he refused to eat any breakfast this morning, not even Sally Lou's apple pancakes, which are his favorites. This is terribly hard on him, Bessie, terribly hard. If he doesn't get the money, we might have to close the store."
"Audrey, I am so sorry to hear all this," Bessie said.
"I wish I could help, but..."
"It gets even worse," Audrey went on. "Sheriff Norris came into the store this morning. He had this very serious look on his face, and he and Mr. Dunlap went into the office and talked for nearly half an hour. When he came out, he asked me what happened after Mr. Whitworth left last night, and I said that Mr. Dunlap went out for a drive, and then he asked what time he got home, and I said midnight. And then he told Mr. Dunlap not to leave town." She pulled in a ragged breath.
"I don't understand what this is all about, Bessie, but I have the feeling that the sheriff thinks
My husband is guilty of something, and Mr. Dunlap won't tell me what it is.
Bessie suspected that Audrey was frustrated because she was being kept in the dark. She would probably feel better if she knew that none of this had anything to do with her husband. In a comforting tone, she said,
I wouldn't worry if I were you, Audrey. I imagine this is about what happened to Mr. Whitworth.
Audrey frowned. Something happened to Mr. Whitworth?
Apparently, Bessie said. People are saying that he's been...
But at that moment, Leona Ruth, who had moved from brooms and mops to stationery and greeting cards beside the big front window, exclaimed with great excitement,
Well, I swan! Just look at that, will you, Bessie? What do you reckon?
Bessie hurried to stand at the front window beside Leona Ruth and saw an odd cavalcade of vehicles parading slowly along the street. The black Ford Roadster at the head of the procession was driven by Mr. Springer, the new sheriff's deputy, with a raincoat-clad fellow in the rumble seat. A drunk, Bessie guessed, the way his head was bent forward. Behind the deputy's car clanked a heavy, steel-wheeled tractor, pulling an ivory-colored automobile with a smashed-in roof. And behind that came a black Ford sedan bearing the Alabama insignia and the words, Jericho State Prison Farm. Audrey came to the window and pushed herself between Bessie and Leona Ruth.
Why, I recognize that wrecked car they're towing, she exclaimed. It's Mr. Whitworth's Pierce Arrow. He was driving it when he came to our house last night.
She pressed her hand to her heaving bosom.
Gracious sakes alive, it is his Pierce Arrow!
Leona Ruth's voice was rising. She was so agitated that the peacock feathers on her purple hat quivered.
And that fellow in the deputy's car, in the rumble seat?
By this time, she was practically screeching.
Why, I'll be blessed if it isn't Mr. Whitworth himself! He must have had too much to drink and wrecked his car and...
But he isn't drunk,
Bessie said, drawing in her breath. She was dizzy with the understanding that Mr. Whitworth had not been kidnapped after all. Or maybe he had been kidnapped and then he had wrecked his car when he tried to speed away from the people who had snatched him.
Just look at all that blood on his head.
Why...
Mr. Whitworth is...
Bessie, I do believe you are right, Leona Ruth shrilled excitedly. Mr. Whitworth is dead. He is dead.
Between the two of them, Audrey let out her breath. Bessie turned to see that her eyes were as big as coat buttons and her face was white as a hanky.
Oh, no, Mr. Dunlap, you didn't, she cried.
Leona Ruth stared at her.
Didn't what?
She demanded.
Audrey Dunlap, you are surely not thinking that your husband had anything to do with Mr. Whitworth being dead, are you?
But Audrey's eyes had rolled up into her head so that only the whites were showing. Before Bessie could grab her, her knees had buckled, and she was flat on the floor.
Chapter 14 Charlie is Buffaloed.
While Bessie and Leona Ruth were getting Audrey back on her feet, Charlie Dickens was rushing into the dispatch office, his tie pulled loose, his fedora pushed to the back of his head, his Rolleiflex in his hand. Ophelia looked up from her typewriter in surprise.
My goodness, she said. What's happened to you?
I'm not the one it happened to, Charlie said breathlessly.
The deputy had wanted his photos in a hurry, so he had driven as fast as he could from the accident scene back to town, but he had to stop at the Standard Station to pick up that flat tire. He shrugged out of his seersucker jacket and hung it beside his desk.
It's Whitney Whitworth, he added, turning around. He's dead.
Dead?
Ophelia stared at him, shocked.
Oh, my golly, dead? Really?
She leaned forward over her typewriter.
How did it happen? When? Are you writing the story?
Unmistakably, undeniably dead. Car wreck.
Accident.
ran off the road at the bottom of Spook Hill sometime last night. And yes, he added firmly, I am writing the story.
Ophelia was always eager to cover events outside her usual women's page stuff, and he tried to accommodate her when he could. But there was no way he was giving her this story. It was his, along with those photographs. She was frowning.
Spook Hill? What in the world was he doing out there? He didn't have business at the prison farm, did he? That's the only thing on that road.
Charlie shrugged.
No idea, he said.
He wasn't surprised by the question. It was what everybody would want to know.
Was he alone?
Her frown intensified.
His wife wasn't with him, I hope.
Nope. He was the only one in the car.
Charlie raised his camera.
Gotta get this film developed and over to the sheriff's office right away.
He was more than glad to be of service. If you did a favor for the sheriff, you could claim a favor in return next week, next month, next year. That's how a real newspaper reporter operated, cashing in on favors when payoff time rolled around.
Oh, dear,
Ophelia said sadly, shaking her head.
Oh, poor Mrs. Whitworth. I hope she has a friend with her when she learns about the accident. She's sort of, well, she's fragile right now. I'm afraid she's going to feel guilty.
Halfway to the curtained-off corner he used for a dark room, Charlie turned.
You know Whitworth's wife?
Yes, of course I know her, Ophelia replied. She and I have been on the decorating committee for the Ladies' Guild for a couple of years. On Friday, it was our turn to put up decorations at the retirement haven, the old folks' home over on Rayburn Road. We needed some orange and brown crepe paper and some red construction paper to make autumn leaves, and Mrs. Dunlap had used everything the Five and Dime had on her window display. So Mrs. Whitworth and I drove over to Monroeville to get it. Or rather, she added, she drove.
She gave a delicate shudder.
To tell the truth, it was pretty nerve-wracking. She's been taking driving lessons in her new car, but she needs a lot more practice.
She blinked.
Gosh, was that the one that got wrecked? Mrs. Whitworth's new car?
No. The one that got wrecked was the Pierce Arrow, the car Whitworth always drives around town. Drove, I mean,
Charlie corrected himself.
He turned to regard Ophelia. Wait a minute. You said she's going to feel guilty?
He frowned.
Why? Why should Mrs. Whitworth feel guilty about her husband getting killed in an automobile accident?
Ophelia sat back in her chair.
Forget I said that.
She held out her hand.
Please, Charlie, I shouldn't have. I'm just guessing, really.
But you did say it. Charlie leaned toward her, scowling. Come on, Ophelia, out with it. Why in the hell should the wife feel guilty about the husband's accident?
Ophelia didn't say anything for a moment. Then she sighed. Obviously reluctant, she said.
Because she's planning to get a divorce. That's why she bought the car. She wants to be independent.
Charlie stared at her, mystified.
And that makes her feel guilty?
Ophelia rolled her eyes.
You know, silly,
she said as if she didn't understand why he was asking.
It's because she was thinking of getting rid of him, and now...
She turned up her hand.
Well, now she's a widow. Wouldn't you feel guilty under those circumstances?
Not in the slightest, Charlie said.
Really, he thought he would never understand women, especially when it came to this independence thing. He paused.
She told you about the divorce?
Yes, she did.
Ophelia sounded a little defensive.
We stopped for a couple of root beers on the way home, and she told me why she bought the car. I think she just needed somebody to talk to, and I happened to be handy.
Did she tell you why she wanted a divorce?
Charlie asked curiously.
Was he seeing another woman, maybe?
Whitworth hadn't struck him as the type who would keep a sweetie on the side, but you never could tell. Even the most conventional people sometimes did unconventional things. He once knew a pastor and a church secretary who ran off to Mexico together, leaving 5 children and 2 bewildered spouses behind. On the other hand, A woman of Mrs. Whitworth's social status and pedigree wouldn't consider a divorce unless she had a substantial reason. The guy must have been getting up to something.
Well, did she? He demanded.
Ophelia lifted her chin. No, she didn't say why, and I didn't ask. A divorce is a very personal thing. It was none of my business. She looked him straight in the eye and added quite firmly, It isn't any of your business either, Charlie Dickens. It doesn't belong in the Dispatch, especially now that Mr. Whitworth is dead. She shook her head sympathetically. Oh, poor Mrs. Whitworth. She's going to feel just dreadful. And she has no family to lean on. Her parents are dead, and she has no brothers or sisters, no support at all. Charlie was thinking fast. Ophelia was certainly right on one score. He couldn't include anything about a possible divorce in his story. The Methodists and Baptists went up in flames whenever they saw the word in print. And, as Ophelia said, the issue was moot anyway, now that Mrs. Whitworth was a grieving widow, or a guilty widow, although the logic of that still escaped him. But the divorce angle aside, maybe he could soften up the story with a little human interest. He gave Ophelia a long look.
So far as I know, Mrs. Whitworth hasn't been notified yet. What would you think about going with the sheriff to break the news? Are you that kind of friend?
I don't know exactly what you mean by that kind of friend, Ophelia said cautiously. But if Buddy Norris thinks I can help, I'll be glad to go along. She glanced up at the clock. Of course, if I do that, I won't be able to cover the meeting of the Share the Wealth Society, but
there'll be another meeting, Charlie cut in. This is more important. I'll call Norris right now.
He went to the phone on his desk and asked the Hello Central girl to speak to the sheriff's office. A few moments and a brief conversation later, he hung up the receiver.
The deputy has taken Whitworth's body to Noonan's funeral parlor, he said. Noonan will need time to clean him up before the widow sees him. Buddy Norris is leaving for the Whitworth house now. He says he'll be glad to have a woman go along, especially a friend of Mrs. Whitworth. He'll pick you up on his way over there.
He frowned.
Where's your notebook?
My notebook? Ophelia stared at him. You mean you want me to...
You're damn right I do, Charlie said impatiently. You're going as a friend, but don't forget, you're a reporter. If you pick up any details about the accident or about Mrs. Whitworth's reaction to it, make a mental note and write them down as soon as you can. Bits of human interest will go a long way to soften the story of the accident. My story, he added quickly, in case Ophelia might be getting ideas.
I don't know if I like this, Ophelia muttered. It isn't the kind of situation where I can just whip out my notebook and...
Doesn't matter whether you like it or not, Charlie said flatly. I'll say it again, Ophelia. You're a reporter. This is your job. Got it? Be a friend and help Mrs. Whitworth get through this. But stay objective, listen hard, and keep your reporter's eye on the situation. On everything that goes on. Remember, human interest is what you're after. Don't get involved. It'll be a good test for you.
With a sigh, Ophelia picked up her notebook and dropped it into her bag. What sort of things are you looking for? Frowning, she shrugged into her pink sweater. Is something going on here that I need to know about, Charlie? Charlie had been asking himself that very same question.
I don't think so, he said, pursing his lips. That business about the divorce has got me thinking. And the deputy was pretty definite about getting photographs. I'm wondering if he spotted something that...
He broke off. Spotted what? Didn't you say it was an accident?
That's what I said.
A car horn sounded on the street outside.
There's the sheriff. You pay attention, you hear? And you're a reporter, looking for human interest. A reporter. Don't get involved. Remember that while you're busy being a friend. Don't get involved.
Ophelia rolled her eyes. Charlie had never been very good at developing film, but when he turned out the red light and pulled the curtain aside, there were 24 photos hanging from the line. It would be a little while before they were dry enough to take down. In the meantime, he rearranged them on the line so they were in order. Not the order he had taken them in, but from the top of the hill to the bottom, following the tracks of the heavy Pierce arrow from the moment Whitworth topped the hill to his somersault at the bottom. At the far end of the line were the photos of the wreck as it lay on the embankment and a couple he had taken of the car's rear end after it had been towed up to the road. Charlie studied the photos for a few moments, his eyes narrowed, brow furrowed. Then he went to his desk, took out a magnifying glass, and went back to the photographs, starting at the beginning, leaning close, peering at details, and moving slowly from one photograph to another. The problem was that there were several sets of tracks, and they intersected, but after a while he straightened, shaking his head. He was buffaloed. He could be wrong, of course. But judging from the tracks, it looked like something had happened on the way down that hill before Whitworth's Pierce arrow had gotten to the bottom and flipped. But he'd be damned if he could figure out what. However, this wasn't the only mystery Charlie had on his mind. All morning long, whenever he stopped thinking about whatever he was thinking about at the moment, his thoughts had returned to the question that was painfully lodged at the back of his mind. It was the mystery of Fanny's money, those monthly $50 checks she was sending to somebody, or something, with the initials J.C. It was like having a tiny thorn stuck in the ball of your foot. It hurts, but you can't find it to pull it out. $50 a month, $600 a year, $600 a year. What was the story on those checks? What kind of secret was his wife concealing? Why hadn't she told him what she was doing? Was it because she didn't trust him? Or because whatever she was hiding was so terrible that she feared that he would... Charlie made himself stop. He couldn't let his brain whirl around and around the problem like a kid's toy top, spinning this way, then that. He had to do something. Good, bad, or indifferent, it didn't matter so long as he was doing it. And at that moment, he decided what he was going to do. The photos were dry enough now so that he could take the copies to the sheriff's office and leave them with the deputy. Then he would walk across the street to the bank. What he wanted was a look at one of those canceled checks to see if the endorsement gave any clue to the identity of the person who had cashed it. Of course, Charlie reminded himself, it was Fanny's account, and there were probably bank rules against letting anybody else take a look. But he was her husband, after all, and he and Al Duffy had gotten to be pretty good friends over the year that Al had been president of the bank. He figured Al would go along with what he wanted to do, although he would have to add one important condition, that Fanny not learn anything about this. His wife would be really angry with him if she found out he was snooping in her business. Chapter 15. The Sheriff Gets the Wrong Idea. Buddy Norris wasn't any too happy as he walked up the steps to the front door, Ophelia Snow right behind him. When he had been here earlier this morning, Mr. Whitworth was a missing person. Now the man was dead, and announcing that tragic news to the next of kin was not a favorite part of Buddy's job. But it was his to do, for although he hadn't been out to the accident scene yet, his deputy had told him what had happened. So he had the story. As much of it as Wayne was able to put together at this point, anyway. There were some loose ends to be tied up, but it was time to notify the new widow. When he rang the Whitworth's doorbell for the second time that day, the sheriff felt pretty well prepared. And because Ophelia Snow had come along, he also felt quite a bit easier in his mind. If there was to be any fainting, Ophelia could handle it. She had smelling salts in that handbag of hers, along with the reporter's notebook he had glimpsed. When he saw that, he had frowned and said, "No note taken while we're in there, Ms. Snow." And Ophelia had rolled her eyes and said, "Yes, buddy," in the tone adults use to little kids when the kid is being a nuisance. Ophelia Snow was one of the darling people who called him Buddy in the way he didn't like. The Snows remembered him from when he was 14 or 15 and had been smitten by one of the daughters of their next-door neighbor. They had seen him riding his old rusty bicycle or hanging out at the swimming hole on Pine Mill Creek, where pretty much everybody in town went to cool off on a hot August Saturday afternoon. They had no doubt heard about him getting into trouble, stealing smokes, catching a ride on an L&N freight car, smacking a baseball through old Mr. Newkirk's dining room window, the things boys do when they don't have a mama to ride herd on them and make sure they do what's right. And now here he was, the sheriff of the town he'd grown up in, which meant that he always had something to prove to folks like the Snows who knew him from back when. And quite a few things to live down, because people in Darling seemed to remember the most embarrassing stuff, like the time somebody stole his breeches and shoes at the swimming hole, and he'd walked home barefoot and humiliated in nothing but his long-tailed shirt. Thankfully, Regina Whitworth had not known him when he was a kid. While she wasn't much older than he was, she had grown up on her grandmother's plantation on the Alabama River, where she had been privately schooled. For once, he would be starting with a clean slate. When the maid showed them into the parlor, Buddy was relieved to see that Mrs. Whitworth had settled down some since the morning. Clutching a hanky and wearing a long-sleeved navy silk dress that emphasized her delicate throat and slender shoulders, she was seated on a garnet velveteen love seat in front of two tall, graceful parlor palms under a large gilt-framed oil portrait of a heavily jeweled woman with a formidable bosom and an autocratic look. Buddy didn't have to guess who that was. The wealthy Helene Marie Vautier, who, he'd heard, had died and left her plantation and her fortune to her granddaughter, Regina, shortly before she became Mrs. Whitworth. Buddy took a chair, gingerly because it looked like a rickety antique, and he wasn't sure it would hold his weight. Ophelia lingered in the doorway, whispering to the maid that it would be a good idea if she brought in a pot of very strong tea. Then she sat down on the love seat close to Mrs. Whitworth. Buddy leaned forward, put his elbows on his knees, and broke the news as gently as he could. "He was killed instantly," he said at the end, hoping that would be a comfort. "Doc Roberts is over in Monroeville this morning and hasn't yet had a look," he added. "But we think that's a safe assumption." There were tears and sobbing, of course, but Ophelia put her arms around Mrs. Whitworth and stroked and patted and soothed, and to Buddy's relief, the worst of the crying was over fairly quickly. The maid appeared with a polished silver teapot and delicate china cups on a silver tray. Ophelia forced a cup on Mrs. Whitworth and poured for herself and Buddy. While they sipped their tea, Buddy was able to ask the question that had been bothering him all morning, ever since he'd heard where the accident happened. "The car went off the road at the foot of Spook Hill," he said. "Do you have any idea why your husband was out there on that road last night?" Mrs. Whitworth pressed her lips together tightly. She looked down at her fingers, twisting her white handkerchief into a tight knot. When she looked up again, her hair swung back, and Buddy saw something he had missed when he talked to her earlier, a dark purplish bruise on her jaw, and an abrasion. And then her hair swung forward again, concealing the injury. Hesitantly, in a low, slow, southern lady voice, she said, "I don't know for sure, but he might have been on his way to meet Bodine Pyle." Buddy was genuinely startled. "Bodine Pyle? You mean—" He thought immediately of what Violet had told him earlier that morning, that Mr. Whitworth might be in the bootleg business with Bodine Pyle. "I should try to hide this to save his reputation," Mrs. Whitworth said, sounding resigned. "But I suppose you ought to know. I do hope you'll keep it to yourself, though. It doesn't have anything to do with—" She twisted the handkerchief again. "With how he died, I mean, since it was an accident." "What is it you want me to know exactly?" Buddy asked, feeling his way. She untwisted her handkerchief and smoothed it out. That he invested money, some, I don't know how much, in Bodine Pyle's liquor business. If I'd had any say in the matter, I would have said no, she added. But he thought he heard a note of something.